You're on Groove 107.7 FM, and it's my very great pleasure to be talking to a broadcaster, scientist and expert on Antarctica now, Veronica Maduna, who's put out a new book called Science on Ice, which is Discovering the Secrets of Antarctica. Welcome, Veronica.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, I say expert on this because you've actually been down there and had a good look around, haven't you?
Still a long way to be an expert, I must say, but for a journalist, for a science journalist, I've had the privilege of going to the ice or to Antarctica twice. That's quite rare. As a scientist, you'd probably be down there almost every summer season, but journalists get to go once normally, and that's a trip of a lifetime, and I thought my first trip would be that, but then I got to go again, and it was fantastic.
Right, and let's start with the basics. What, first of all, you're a science reporter, which is, in this day and age, a very rare thing, especially in New Zealand. Where did that come from?
I am a scientist by background. I trained and worked as a microbiologist. But even when I was a first-year student of biology, I sort of noticed that I really loved everything about science, and I spend a lot more time talking to other people doing other areas, you know, working in other areas of science, talking about their work than actually, swatting up for exams and things like that. So I knew early on that I would probably struggle becoming more and more specialized, because in a purely scientific career, you usually end up dealing with a rather small question that's a part of a bigger picture, but your own focus is small. So there was a point where I had to make that decision, you know, will I continue a scientific career or will I look at other ways of using it? And journalism was an obvious choice. I'd started writing about science as a first-year student, first for the local daily newspaper, then it became a national daily newspaper, and then when we moved to New Zealand, after a while here, I then made that switch to journalism and then quickly became quite specialised on science.
Do you think that inquiring mind sort of comes from your background? You were telling me off air that you were originally born in the former Czech Republic and then escaped across to Germany. So I guess there's sort of that sense of discovery and opening of eyes and that kind of thing. Do you think that was early on in your life that's led to why you're a journalist and not so much a scientist as well, perhaps?
Possibly. I haven't actually put those two things together in that same way. I would certainly say yes on that inquiring mind about an interest in science. That was there quite early on. I'll never forget my dad becoming quite impatient with me. I was probably about five or some age like that. And I kept asking him questions about, you know, how do you make paint? What is it in paint that gives it the colour? Those sort of things that he often didn't quite know the answers and had to go and look it up. And he tells me now, you know, many, many years down the track, that he was learning with me as I was asking all these questions. So that inquiring mind has probably always been there, just a curiosity about how things work and why they are the way they are. I haven't connected the two things, the escape and the sort of, you know, landing in a new country and having to adjust to a new country, but I have looked back at that time as a big adventure, so I think in that same sense I would have thought of that as a great thing to happen to us rather than some, you know, sad family journey.
Yeah, indeed. Well, speaking of great adventures, of course, you've gone to the place that I think just about every New Zealander would like to put on their bucket list, Antarctica. And the book that you've produced is both accessible and but it's not condescending either. It's sort of somewhere in between, which I really appreciate because I do work a little bit in the science field, but I'm not an expert on this particular field. So I found it just about the right balance, I guess.
That's great to hear, because it's always a tricky thing to find a way of writing about things that are often complex and, you know, need a degree of explaining, but at the same time I don't think that science should be closed off to anybody, no matter what their background, really.
No, and that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because science, I guess, the philosophers will say that it's become the new religion and we're over that now, but it is really, evidence-based science is in just about everything, particularly the argument on things like climate change and things like that. We get bombarded by this information, but there's still very, very little reporting of the detail and making sense of all that in our own journalism these days, isn't there?
Yes, but it has changed for the better in the decade or so, just over a decade that I've been producing the science program for Radio New Zealand. It has actually improved. I remember in the early days, my program would be the only science program. Now, at least, there's a few other people writing, if not solely, then mostly about science. But I'd, you know, having said that, I'd agree that there's still far too little. And I think the interest in the readers and listeners would be there if we gave them more. I think they'd happily have it. So I think the shortcoming is really in the within the media industry.
And the ability to produce good quality stuff.
Yeah, but even that, I think, could be supplied. I have found, you know, over the years, I've met a lot of journalists who are actually interested in covering science. Not necessarily coming from a science background, but I don't think you always need that. If you've got a passion and a genuine interest, that's the more important prerequisite. But there's still a reluctance to dedicate an entire person to just a science round, I think. You know, an entire, you know, full-time staff member to cover science and environment as a main round. It's often still a secondary round to some other major issue that's thought more significant.
Yes. And
however, it's been changing, so I think we are, you know, moving in the right direction, if slowly.
Indeed. And major issues is what your book covers. Just getting back to this one for a moment. Before we go into that, what took you to Antarctica?
I was already producing the science program for Radio New Zealand. I was in my second year of that, and that helped. You know, if you can tell Antarctica, New Zealand, that if you get to go, you will be able to produce programs just about Antarctic science. That is one of the ways of getting down there. Most of the journalists who have gone down there have covered the science in one way or another. In my case, it was broadcasting, but there's been print journalists going down. So that's how the first trip happened. And during that first trip, I happened to be covering the early stages of a major Antarctic drilling geology paleoclimate project. So then I knew when they would be ready to drill the first drill hole, and I really wanted to go back for their first drilling season. So the second trip was much more clearly focused on that particular project because I simply wanted to cover when they bring up the first core.
Yes, tell me, when they drill down to a core, I mean, I think I've got the information or the facts right, that when you drill down, each layer that you find basically is like a frozen version of a microclimate, and you can work your way through the years further, the deeper you go. Is that how it works?
That's if you find the right spot. You know, thinking geology, sometimes the layers aren't purely chronological, so that's why there's a lot of preparation work to be done first. But if you can find a spot where the geology hasn't been upturned too much and where it hasn't been mixed up too much, then you get exactly that. You get a chronological layer. The deeper you go, the further back in time you travel. And even though what you're getting is rocks and mud and dirt, basically, you can still read a lot of information from that. In this particular case, this is the ANDRIL project, Antarctic Drilling Project. They have now drilled two holes, and there's plans for further holes, and I was there for the first hole to be drilled. They managed to go back 5 million years in time.
Wow, how deep would that be?
This was more than 1,000 meters, I think 1,200 meters and something, into the sediment. Now, that logistically, they were drilling from the top of the Ross ice shelf, so they had to first drill through about 800 meters off the ice, then drop the whole drill bit through the ocean, which is another 800 meters of water, and then start drilling into the sediment. And from there, there was another 1,200 plus meters.
Yes, well, hang on. How do you get how do you get a drill? Well, obviously, you don't have a drill that's long. So how do you do that, and how do you get it to come up through all those various layers without it being compromised?
An engineering question, and I might just have to, I'd love to be able to pass you on to the people who've designed it, but it's not dissimilar to drill rigs that are being used to drill for oil. They also go quite deep, and basically the drill bit is rotating within a sort of construction that you can push deeper and deeper with the drill bit. But it is very common, yeah, especially in Antarctica and sitting on ice, you also have the sideways movement of the tidal movement and the swell. So it is a hugely complex engineering feat. actually designed in New Zealand. This is one of the the contributions that New Zealand makes to Antarctic science generally, because the drilling technology for ice conditions like that has been designed in New Zealand and is continually being developed in New Zealand and is used for other projects elsewhere, you know, internationally.
Yeah, and speaking of, there's a certain amount of uncovering the past that you cover in this book, and a number of things, and there's also the study of glaciology, which is covered a bit, and that's looking at a number of things, including what you've mentioned there. One note that you had there is you said that New Zealand has found its own scientific niche at low-level coastal sites.
Yeah.
Now, why is that different to, say, drilling down into the earth or looking at the movement of the various shelves and things like that?
You have to distinguish between the two things. You can drill into the sediment or you can drill through ice. Both the sediment and ice are archives of information from the past. Sediments go back much, much further. We're talking millions of years here. The ice cores, the information there is a little bit more myopic. We're talking tens or hundreds of thousands of years, but it is, the resolution is better, so you really get layer by layer, often just annual layers. And the ice cores still have, trapped in the bubbles of air in the ice, a sample of ancient atmospheres. So it's the ice cores that actually give us the relationship between the temperature at the time and the concentration of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, those sort of gases. And you can literally look back and measure those concentrations. And when I talk about New Zealand having found its particular niche, this is referring to ice core drilling. There is a vast network, an international network of glaciologists working throughout Antarctica and bringing up ice cores to look back at past climates. The most famous of those ice cores is from Lake Vostok, the Russian team. They've drilled down, well, now they have pierced the lake itself, so they've actually drilled into the lake, but before they started focusing on getting through to the lake, they had done almost 3,800 meters of ice cores initially for climate research. There's another ice core that's not quite as long, but actually goes further back in time because the ice layers are more condensed. But most of those glaciologists are in central Antarctica on the polar plateau. New Zealand has gone to the coastal sites partly because they get the foul weather. They get a lot more precipitation, a lot more snow falls there. So the layers are thicker, and you get in some of those sites really like annual rings, like annual tree rings. So although you're not looking back quite as far in the past, you can get a lot more detailed resolution and information year by year. And it's been a really good tool to look at some of the faster changes in climate. Rather than the big picture of, you know, what Earth, Antarctica looked like, say, 800,000 years ago, you can almost look at annual changes.
Well, that's interesting. And you say that you can look back over what has happened with Antarctica over these number of years. Do you think you could also look at what has washed into Antarctica from the various seas and the freezing and all the things that have been dragged in there? Because, you know, being at the pole, I guess it's dragging up the different environments and watching them come and go and leave and so forth because of, you know, all the weather and so forth. Do we measure that as well?
Yeah, also ice cores are brilliant for that. The bubbles in the ice cores have the ancient atmosphere, so you can look at the greenhouse gas concentration and temperature. But in the ice, also frozen, is dust, and the dust tells you a lot about how vigorous the atmosphere was, how stormy it was, where the dust came from. You can actually tell where it's been blown in from.
So you can trace it back to its origins?
Yeah.
Wow, so it could be something from the Americas or Africa or something like that.
Surprisingly, a lot of the dust in our patch of Antarctica and the Ross Sea region actually comes from South America.
Wow.
So, but you can also, you know, the dust will tell you something about the atmospheric movement, but you can also see spikes for sulfuric acid from volcanic eruptions, for example. So you can see some of those events in the ice still.
Wow, that's great. That's going to provide quite a big picture. How long does the project, is the project supposed to go for?
You're thinking the ANDRIL project, drilling?
Sorry, the ANDRIL project, yes.
The ANDRIL project, so we're back to sediment drilling. And remember for that one, this is really going back millions of years. Mm-hmm. So in that first drill hole, For Enderal, they went back 5 million years, which was back to a geological time called the Pliocene. And that was of interest because that's a time where we already know it was warmer. Sea levels were about 20 meters higher. Temperatures were 2 to 3 degrees warmer. And carbon dioxide concentrations were roughly as we're expecting to reach now. But, of course, 5 million years ago, it was a time when, you know, the first apes were maybe just about starting to walk upright. It's a long way from there to the evolution of humans. So this is a time that, you know, is way in the distant past for us as a species. And geologists look at that as an analog for what we might be heading into. In that time frame alone, in the 5 million years, the Ross Ice Shelf, the biggest slab of floating ice at the moment, has disappeared completely, not just once, but 40 times. So in that time frame, just with changing temperatures and concentrations of greenhouse gases, Antarctica, at least at the fringes, at these floating ice shelves, has changed so significantly that the rest of the planet would be a very different world to live in.
So we can make assumptions that there is like a cycle going on or something like that, or is it more to it than that?
There are natural cycles going on. So when you're going that far back, you sort of try to observe both. You observe those natural fluctuations, and they are going on and will continue to go on. But the concentrations of greenhouse gases that we are reaching now have not been reached in the lifetime of not just us as Homo sapiens, but all our hominid predecessors. So really, I'm talking evolution of humans completely. So we've not lift through anything like what we're heading into in terms of concentrations of greenhouse gases. So when you look that far back, it's really sort of trying to get an idea of how Antarctica changed. Has it melted? How often has it melted? How much of it has melted? How much of it has changed shape? To get some idea of what we might expect with the anthropogenic climate change now, which is on top of those natural cycles. When you observe that far back, you can see how much difference the natural cycles make and how much we're doing on top of that now.
Wow. And your second chapter, just to change the subject, your second chapter looks at the animal life in Antarctica, life on ice. Did you think that you learned much, particularly when you're looking at things like emperor penguins, and do you think their way of living, the way that they've adapted, and that, do you think that's changed a lot over the years?
Well, in fact, it only changed quite recently, I think last month or 6 weeks ago. And this is one of the advances in technology that keeps changing, and science keeps changing with it. It was the first complete survey of a species done from space using satellite images. Now, satellite images have been used for a long time to assess Antarctica's size, the size of the sea ice that grows every winter, and sort of doubles the size of the continent, and its satellites have been used to assess the movement of the ice cap itself and the changes, but they have not been used to monitor or survey a species. Add to that improved technology to analyze satellite imagery,
to actually be able to distinguish between
what's a penguin and what's a shadow, or what's just a dark spot. And for the Empress, the result of that was that the population size actually doubled just through that latest survey. So I think, you know, overall we're still getting really new information from the continent, just thanks to changing technology. But when you look at the species and its adaptation to living in that environment, Empress and the Adélie penguins, they are the two truly Antarctic penguins. All of the penguins, of course, live in the, you know, southern hemisphere, but those two need to live in Antarctica. They need ice flows. For the Empress, they need ice to breed on, and both Adélie and Empress need ice flows to forage from. They need to be sitting on ice and feeding and foraging from there. So they're truly Antarctic. And, of course, the Emperors have managed to adapt to this winter breeding cycle, which seems, I think I say in the book, it seems almost suicidal because the temperatures are extreme. With the wind chill, you get down to minus 50, minus 60 Celsius. But they managed to keep those eggs in the plus 15, 16, 17, up to 20 degree range. So they managed to keep those eggs sometimes 80 degrees warmer than the outside temperature.
Wow.
They managed to keep themselves warm enough, and that's thanks to this, you know, huddling in large groups where you spend a lot of time inside that group being insulated from the wind by the others, and then, you know, at some point it's your turn to move out and you kind of take the brunt of the cold for a while and then you move inside again. One of the biologists told me that actually the emperors have adapted so well that one of their problems is not getting too hot while you're in the middle of that scrum.
Goodness.
So that combined with their, you know, layer of blubber and the extremely well insulated coat of feathers makes it possible for them to not just survive the winter, but to raise their chicks in the middle of the winter. And the reason why they do it is to have the chicks ready to fledge at a time when it's that short summer, you know, when it's warm enough for a young bird to just go to the ocean, and when there's enough food and the food's close to the coast and they can start their first, you know, foraging independently. Of course, the survival rate of the chicks in that first year is not very high, but if they do reach adulthood, if they do come back to breed, an adult emperor has a pretty good chance to grow old.
Oh, true. And anybody who's seen much of the penguins, of course, would have observed it from a more anthropological point of view.
Yeah.
What humans find interesting is that it's their, I guess their approach to living seems very much like a human approach. It's very tribal, and there's set patterns and things like that, but there's some definite, human. Perhaps we can see some humanity in the way that they operate. And
I guess it sort of touches on some emotional cord when you see a creature to manage in a essentially hostile environment, and you know, the tragedy is never too far, in a sense that chicks are lost during that breeding attempt, and adults are, you know, lost too, and some don't find their way back to the colony.
Of course. Your final chapter, which looks at beyond the ice, now this is Antarctica as a listening post for astrologers and physicists of a degree, looking at the after effects of the Big Bang and other things like that. What did you mean by that?
This is research that's taking place in Antarctica because it's the best place for it, and in many ways probably the only place. When you imagine Antarctica, the South Pole, it's surrounded by this circumpolar current, which isolates it, but equally it's surrounded by an atmospheric vortex that is also swirling around it. And that means that right above the South Pole, the atmosphere is actually more transparent than anywhere else, so you can see easier and further back in time into the younger universe. But also, you know, on top of that, it's obviously far away from any light pollution. There is simply no light pollution at that spot.
Right. What about electromagnetism and things like that?
It depends what technology you use, but that doesn't normally interfere with the type of telescopes or the type of instruments that they've built around the South Pole. And one that I describe in the book is the Ice Cube. Yeah, that's literally an ice cube. It's an upside-down telescope in many ways, capturing neutrinos. What they've done is they've drilled holes into the ice in a cubic kilometre, so, you know, square kilometre of area, and they've drilled a kilometre deep, and they've sunk the detectors into the ice. Like, in each hole is a string beaded with those detectors. So they've filled a cubic kilometre of ice with detectors that are capturing the neutrinos. Again, the ice itself is quite transparent down there because it's so densely compacted. And neutrinos, of course, they have no charge and very little mass, so they travel through the planet, straight through or through everything, really. They are not deflected by anything. So it's the best way to capture those neutrinos.
Wow, great. Well, we could talk all day about this, but...
Could I add one thing?
Yes.
I would really like to put in a plug for some other creature that survives on ice.
Yes, indeed.
Bacteria and some of the other microscopic or just about visible creatures. But maybe, you know, if we just do the bacteria, because bacteria are really and have always been the dominant life forms on Earth. They do go back to the beginning of life on Earth, and for half of life's time on Earth, it was only bacterial. And of course, you do find them in Antarctica, and initially, even the soils were thought sterile, and then people started discovering bacteria not just surviving but thriving in some parts of Antarctic soil. But most of Antarctica is, of course, covered in ice, and now people are looking at the entire ice sheet as being alive, even though on a, you know, bacterial scale, but still alive. And of course, Lake Vostok has just recently been opened, so the question now, the big question is, will there be life in that lake? Throughout the ice core itself, as they were drilling down, there was viable bacterial populations in the ice, so now really it remains to be seen whether the lake itself harbors some form of life. If it does, it would have been isolated from the rest of the planet, really, for 15, 20 million years. I'd be really curious to see what it is. If it is anything, it'll be bacterial, but it could still be something within the bacterial kingdom that hasn't been seen before.
Hopefully it won't take that long to find it, though.
Hopefully next Antarctic summer, next southern season. Yeah.
Well, are you going? Are you planning on going back again?
I am looking at various projects that I'd like to join, and I'd certainly, you know, I'd go back any time. The only thing holding me back at the moment is that I have a 2.5-year-old, so I'm sort of reluctant to be that far away for a long time with no way to come back in a hurry. However, there are, you know, this particular subglacial lake drilling project is of huge interest to me, so I wouldn't say no.
And Kathmandu make clothes for little ones these days.
That's right.
Veronica, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Veronica is the author of Science on Ice, which is Discovering the Secrets of Antarctica, out on Auckland University Press. And it is $59.99, and you can get it now.